Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 81 of The Psych Files, part two of my interview with Dr. Martha Strauss, in which she talks about no-talk therapy. So, as I said in the previous episode, and I think it's a good idea, if you haven't listened to that one, have a listen to episode 80, in which she talks about some of the groundwork, some of the background behind no-talk therapy. But in this episode, we talk specifically about what the therapy is like. So I think you will find this particularly interesting if you are a therapist, someone interested in becoming one or curious about what happens in therapy, and if you're interested in child and adolescent or play therapy. So let's go to part two. All right, so we've talked about all the reasons that talking, why we feel we need to do it, why it may not be helpful. So then tell, what are some of the goals of no talk? What is it like? You know, give us a sense of it.
I think I want to answer this in specific sort of in the room ways and sort of theoretical underpinning ways. And so in terms of the sort of what the theoretical underpinning, I've already talked about the overarching question of secure love and helping children find a secure place in the world as one of the overarching purposes of treatments and supporting families. In the literature, there is no difference among the therapies, even though people say CBT is better for this or for that.
That's cognitive behavioral therapy.
CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. There's actually no evidence that supports that. There are sometimes more studies done on CBT than other modalities. But when other studies are done, it ends up being no difference at all. There's no difference, really, ultimately. What we have found is that the specific technique, the thing you do in the room, accounts for less than 7% of the variance in why it is people get better. So out of all of the possible explanations and experiences that go into making therapy successful, the specific thing that we are doing really is not as important as our belief in understanding why we're doing what we're doing and that it can be helpful, and the relationship that we form with the person that we're in therapy with or the family. And so, theoretically speaking, I believe in no-talk therapy, and I'm going to explain why specifically, but in general, I don't feel that much of a need to defend it against CBT and the more solution-focused approaches. I'm not against them. I use them. I incorporate them. But I understand that the specificity of the technique, what I am doing in the room, is much less important than some other elements of my engagement, my authentic engagement, intentional engagement as an adult with a child. And so no-talk therapy is premised on children develop, if they have someone to be close to and something to be proud of, they're going to be okay. Mm-hmm. And so no-talk therapy's most foundational premise is that I want to find a way for children to have something to be proud of and someone to be close to in order for them to get traction and have place in their own lives. Mm-hmm. And so my goals have in them certainly a goal of relationship, of secure attachment. I think of this in a couple of ways. One, of course, is in the safe, stable, predictable, nurturing relationship with me as a therapist. But I certainly want them to have more adults in their lives. And I do a lot of work with families and parents and strengthening those attachments as the primary. I'm building obsolescence into my work. I mean, therapy not only is an intentional relationship, which distinguishes it from others, but it's a relationship that intentionally ends. And so I want to make sure that at that point, when it ends, that the child is experiencing the capacity to love and be loved with other adults as well in a safe, supportive, predictable way. I joke that the real ADD in our culture is adult deficit disorder. So when we're talking about a goal in no-talk therapy, we're talking about making sure that children have many adults in their lives that love and know them. So that's the someone to be close to. And then the something to be proud of or something to, that you feel good at is really about building competency in kids. We know a tremendous amount from the literature about what makes children resilient, helps them, what kind of environments promote resiliency, how resilient kids are different than their more vulnerable peers. And so I think a lot about school, where they spend tremendous amount of time. Is the school program, the school environment, one that is meeting their needs and responsive to them, to where they feel they belong, where they feel they can be competent? Do they need a different kind of education plan? Do they need a different setup of a classroom?
So you want them to experience success in school?
I want them to experience success in multiple environments, but certainly in school, yeah. That a lot of the children, because, you know, kids spend so much time in school. A lot of children are, if they're failing and feeling that they're failing in school, and that's socially and academically, we need to figure out what are their learning styles and strengths and weaknesses so that we are providing. And it's federal law. It's not just my own idea. You know, the federal law says they have to have an education that meets their needs. So I think part of no-talk therapy is making modifications in an environment so that the environment helps the child become more successful. Certainly, peer and social skills is another area that is without a doubt in, I mean, one of the most robust psychology literatures is about friends and the capacity to make friends and the capacity to sustain friendships is probably the most important, or, you know, I don't know how you hierarchize this, but certainly one of the top three most important developmental tasks of childhood. And in prospective and retrospective and large scale and epidemiological, I mean, every kind of study you can imagine says the same thing, which is that children who have social skills have the capacity to make friends and sustain friendships do better in every dimension, psychologically, socially, academically, in self-esteem, in competence. And children who are bullied and marginalized and lack isolated and lack social skills have very poor outcomes, both in the present and over the long term. If you look at who's living in marginal ways in our society, people with substance abuse problems, who are incarcerated, who have major mental illness, you will more often than not find someone that had poor social skills in childhood. So there's no dimension on which this isn't very important. And so the children that I work with, I also work very hard to find a peer group for if they don't have, and find opportunities to be connected to age mates to the extent that they're capable and developmentally appropriate ways to find opportunities to learn and develop those skills.
And, you know, hopefully this speaks to the times when maybe a parent is sitting in on what appears to be a play therapy, but maybe it's no-talk therapy, and nothing seems to be being, quote-unquote, accomplished because the therapist is just playing with toys. But you're saying that that's sort of goal number one, which is build a trusting relationship.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the question I would put back to the parent is, what would you like to have accomplished? Tell me about who you want to be bringing into the, what kind of person are you trying to have your child become? What are you looking for? What are your hopes and dreams and aspirations? What do you want to accomplish? Let's say this is the most successful thing you've ever done. You know, this therapy, this coming to see me is just transformative. What will it look like? What will be different? What will you notice? How will it feel when it's successful? And so helping the parents articulate what it is they're looking for also helps us define what, how to explain the task and whether it's being accomplished.
And I would assume most parents would say, you know, I want my child to be confident, you know, secure, you know, have friends. Those kinds of things.
Yeah. And so I would say, here are the ways in which, according to where your child is developmentally, and it's about developmental level, not chronological age, I am communicating with your child in a way that enables them to feel confident and engaged and seen and understood and supported. And, you know, it's not that it's with I don't challenge, but I challenge within the frame of what we in the attachment world call adoring eyes. The idea is that I am much better able to guide you and challenge you when you know and can feel my love and support as foundational. And until you know and feel welcomed and like you belong in my office and that I'm glad to see you and that you are lovable because I am expressing that through my presence and my authenticity and my warmth and availability to what is important to you. Once you feel that, I have a lot more leeway to push and challenge and shape help shape your experience. So you're not defended against hearing what it is or hammered by me. It turns out when people hammer us, we don't really actually learn very much. Right. Any of us.
So once you have established that kind of relationship, you're saying that the next areas of focus for you are what's going on in school, what is the friend situation like. So do you deal with those things with the child, or I mean, I would assume you'd also have to reach out to the schools.
Yeah, I think that both. It would be both. And part of the both is our responsibility as adults to shape and create successful environments for children and to make that our adult agenda, that so that if I will engage a child, certainly a child with attention deficit disorder, I'm going to work on finding out behaviorally what it is they can do and what their executive functioning level is and how we help them delay gratification a little bit and work on, I mean, it's not that I don't work on stuff like that, but I'm also really interested in finding out how we shape environments in which they can be more successful, putting them in the front of the room, presenting information in a couple of ways, providing for them the external structure and support so that they can be successful because we know they can't do it. I mean, so much of the intervention is helping environments meet children at their developmental level and not having these expectations. I have this great memory of when my own older child, who's now finishing college, was 13, and she's a fine student, a pretty together kid. And in middle school, I was having to go back to school like two or three times a week to go pick up stuff she'd forgotten. And I realized that I could be really upset with her for having poor organizational skills. Then I realized, well, she has poor organizational skills. What are all the other kids doing? And where is the expectation that someone with the brain of a 12 or a 13-year-old should be well organized? I mean, if you know someone that's like that, they're an outlier developmentally. Mm-hmm. So the expectation is that someone who is in middle school with six different teachers and classes and all the social brouhaha and hormones and their brains are undergoing this profound remodeling, that they should have the organizational skills to remember all their assignments. Mm-hmm. We're setting everyone up for failure. The parents are mad because their kid doesn't remember stuff, and the child feels bad because they can't hold it together. Have you ever looked in the backpack of a 12-year-old? It's a horrifying thing. And that's just the way it is. Mm-hmm. So there's this guy, Dan Weinberger, at the National Institute of Health, who had a great line that I love. He said that adults have an obligation to provide a land lease prefrontal cortex to kids until they develop their own. And so the idea is children problem solve like children. They don't have adult brains. Only adults problem solve like adults.
So I see how your two goals are coming together. Someone to be close to, you're spending the time to build an authentic, warm, accepting, loving relationship. And then something to be proud of, you're getting involved in the you're doing concrete things in the various aspects of the child's life to make sure that they are being successful in school, successful with friends, being able to feel proud of themselves, building a self-esteem.
And having extracurricular interests, I think that's the other piece of the pride. Mm-hmm. People have to develop talents and interests, and we all have them. And a lot of the no-talk kids that I work with come in, and they don't feel good at anything. And that's part one of the reasons they can be pretty shut down and unwilling to take risks. So friends and doing better in school and also fostering and finding passions and interests and talents, because for all our days, that's what we need.
You mean like the ability to play guitar or, you know, those kinds of talents?
Yeah, that's right. I have a great example. Last year I was treating a young man, a 13-year-old boy, who was sort of depressed and sullen and very nonverbal, parents going through a very acrimonious divorce, wouldn't even be in the same room to support him, very upset with him, flunking school. And he'd come into my office and just be a depressed kid. I found out kind of inadvertently after several weeks of just, what am I going to do with this kid? You know, you want to play cards? You know, I didn't care. I'd do anything just to engage him. And he was just sitting there like a lump. And I found out, out of desperation, that he really loved animals. And he had a couple of dogs and rural kid, lived on a farm. Just, you know, that was his thing. And but he didn't think much of it. Yeah, so I like animals. And I said, asked his mom if I can help arrange for him to work for a vet a couple afternoons a week, cleaning out cages or whatnot. Would that be okay? And she said, yeah, it's fine. Long as, it's on the days that I have him, because dad might not take him. So I called up a vet I knew. I mean, this is small town stuff, but it's a really nice example. I mean, this kid was a completely shut down, depressed, pretty hopeless, no interests, barely, skating by kind of kid. And I asked him, would he go meet with this vet that I knew? And he kind of shrugged and he went. And I guess the first day that he was there, the vet had him observe. I mean, the kid said he helped, but I assume he was just observing in the spaying of a Bernese Mountain Dog. And those big dogs got spayed. And this boy came in, and he talked for an entire hour, like nonstop, in graphic detail about the spaying of this dog. And it was a transformative moment that had very little to do with my therapy and more to do with my sense that I'm not doing such a good job on someone to be close to right now. Let's figure out if there's some other way to engage him and something to be proud of and excited by and passionate about. And it got him changing in school, his attitude in school, because the vets, if you want to do this, man, you got to do well in math. You certainly have to graduate middle school.
All right, well, let me just sort of wrap up with a couple of questions. Has there been research on the approach?
There is no research on the specific approach because it's really a trans-theoretical model that I am using. So it's what people are calling evidence-based. There is certainly evidence for some forms of play and relational therapies. There's evidence for systemic kinds of interventions that I'm doing, working with families and school systems. And there's evidence for developmental approaches to working with children where you meet them at the developmental level and look at, for example, their problem-solving strategies and decide how to, raise their problem-solving strategies another notch. So I would say I've never done any research on no-talk therapy specifically, but I would say that I have a justification and an explanation that is based in evidence. I mean, I think articulate and have, as I just did with you, with families, sort of what my methodology is and why I think it is helpful.
Mm-hmm. In other words, it's made up of pieces of other therapeutic techniques, each of which have a sound basis to them.
That's right. And situated in my own knowledge base and my own clinical experience and my conceptualization of what the specific needs of the specific child and family in front of me. So I'm able to tailor it in a very, very specific way.
So finally, if someone is interested in this or would like to see more of this kind of approach with their child, what do you suggest? I mean, of course, you know, you could say, well, I can go to you, but, you know, if you're out in Idaho, I mean, you know, what do you do?
Well, I think the main thing I would say on that is to really talk to therapists when you are trying to get a therapist for your child about how they work and how inclusive they are of families and how they understand development and language. And I would encourage parents to know about development and talk and sort of the relative virtues of play and talk kinds of therapy, and figure out for their own child what modality or combination of modalities would make the most sense. I actually think that as I travel around talking to therapists and teaching this stuff, a lot of people are already doing variants on it and kind of ashamed and hiding it, because what happens is people say, okay, I'm going to do this specific cognitive behavioral work with this child. And then the child comes in and he sees a ball in the corner and he just starts bouncing it around. And he's not talking, but he's playing ball. And so you can keep yelling at the child to sit down and talk. But I think what most people, when they actually have real children in the room, is they play with them. And they engage with them the way the child can engage, because it's pragmatic. And so what ends up happening is I think a lot of people are hiding behind a methodology, which might be right, improve self-soothing and problem-solving strategies, you know, that kind of languaging. Mm-hmm. But the way they're doing improving self-soothing and problem-solving strategies is by playing with children, because they're children. Mm-hmm. Right? So I think most people end up doing some variants on no-talk therapy and may or may not feel safe copping to it. So the parents can say, it's okay if you play with my child. Tell me how you work. Mm-hmm. And they may find out that there's a lot more flexibility out there and a lot more acceptance of children as children out there among therapists. So I think that more people are doing, you know, a lot of times people say, oh, that's so affirming. I've been doing this and I've been afraid to tell anyone. I hear that very, very often.
Yeah. Interesting, yeah. Well, I've learned a lot from your book and from this discussion, you know, in my endless pursuit to be a better parent. And, you know, I learn a lot. I was speaking with Ross Green who recently, mm-hmm. and you mentioned him in your book as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's wonderful.
Yeah, and we pick up some good stuff. And hopefully this That's has great. Been a good listen for both the parents and for therapists who listen to the Psych Files. I understand you have a new book aimed at adolescent girls. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. My new book that came out last fall, October 2007, is called Adolescent Girls in Crisis, Intervention and Hope. And it's a book that is primarily aimed for counselors and therapists and people who work with adolescent girls, but it has more general sections for parents and how to approach both an understanding of adolescent girls as individuals and as part of a complicated and often very toxic cultural press development, and how to work with them in different kinds of problems they might present with.
So is this aimed at therapists or parents or both?
Primarily at therapists, as no-talk therapy is. These are Norton professional books, so the primary audience is people who work with adolescents, but parents often find the ideas and suggestions and how to think about different problems also useful. So it has broader application for parents who want to know more. The interventions that are discussed tend to be more in the therapeutic side, but a girl is self-harming, what to do about it.
You've had more experience with adolescent females than...
Well, having raised two of them also, and having been one, it seemed like a natural topic, although I began the book before my girls became adolescents. And, it slowed me down a little bit. My expertise didn't seem so expert having my own. Mm-hmm. So that slowed me down. But yeah, it came out of a lot of clinical work that I've done over the years, specifically with that population, adolescents in general, and adolescent girls even more particularly.
And the particular problems they face during that period of time.
That's right. Yeah, looking at problems that are really much more prevalent among girls and boys, such as, you know, sexual acting out and self-harm and eating disorders. I focus on general adolescent development and problems, but then also specifically more on the kinds of issues that girls seem to be facing and how that is and what to do about it.
Okay. And that was called what again?
Adolescent Girls in Crisis, Intervention and Hope. It's up on my website, and there's a link and stuff if people are interested in learning more about it.
What's the name of your website again?
MarthaStrauss.com.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank
Dr.
you
Strauss.
So much. It's been great fun.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Take care. All right. There we go. Well, once again, Dr. Martha Strauss, thank you so much. Feel free to visit her website, www.marthastrauss.com. And also check out the Psych Files if you're studying for an upcoming test. I have some very helpful brain mnemonics, and the reaction to the PDF that I have available on the site has been really good so far. So if you need to memorize the parts of the brain, and not only the parts, but the functions, what those parts do, I think you'll find this to be very helpful. Memorable images that I had fun making. If you're interested in mnemonics, I think you'll like this too. So check it out at www.thepsychfiles.com. Okay, thanks a lot. Hope you enjoy these interviews with Dr. Strauss, and we'll see you next time on the Psych Files. Take care.